Our topic is going to be the Vineyard of Navot. This is such an unusual story in so many ways. It is the 21st perek in Sefer Melachim Aleph, and it stands by itself, meaning to say, you could technically speaking read this in a vacuum and try to understand it on its own grounds, and then also try to understand it in the context of the backdrop of where it actually is. So let's try to do a little bit of both of those together. So starting at the very beginning, with this perek is the perek Chaf Aleph. Let's take a look at some of the psukim. So we're told we're going to look at sort of parts of the drama, stage by stage, appreciate the injustice, and then reflect on it. So we're told the following: it was after these matters that came to pass. There was an individual but called Navot or Navos who lived in Israel. He had a vineyard, Asher be Yisrael, Eitzel Heichel Achav Melech Shomron. He happened to be the next door neighbor to Achav the king. Vaydaber Achav El Navos Lemorsa. Forgive me. He spoke to Achav saying, I'm sorry, excuse me for a second. Sorry, I apologize, something in the throat. Let's try again. Vaydaber Achav El Navos Lemos. So Achav comes over to Navos and he says, Tanali es akarmacho vayihi li legan yorak. Please transfer rights of ownership of your vineyard to me. It'll be my green garden. I want to have a nice, pleasant garden. Ki korve etzel beisi. It's near my house. Ve'etna lecha tachtav kerem tov mimena. I'll give in its place a better vineyard. And you can also name whatever price you want. So he makes a very, sounds like a fairly reasonable proposition. And he says to him, God forbid I should give my ancestral heritage to you. It's a bit of a strong response, right? Like, Navos, calm down. He's just asking if he wants to buy your yard. Right, so Navos seems to take this very personally. Right? Why? We have to think about. We now hear. He comes back and he's very upset. He's very upset that he's been refused to buy the property of Navos. He turns his face to the wall. He does not eat bread. She says, why is it you're so upset? Why aren't you eating? Look, I made this request to buy his vineyard. I'll replace it with another vineyard. And he refused. You should be king over Israel. You go up and get bread. Eat bread, v'yitav libecha, make your heart satiated, ani eten lecha es, kerem Navos Yisraeli, I will give you the vineyard. V'tichtov svarim, v'shem achav, v'tachton b'chosamoy, v'tishlach sefarim el hazakinim, v'el achorim asher b'iroi, v'yashrim el Navos. So she sends a letter signed with the king's seal to the elders of the city of Navot, v'tichtov asvarim lemor, and this is what she says. I'll make a fast day, and in a fast day there'll be this communal gathering. Navos should be placed on the podium. So take him out, make an accusation. She says, rent for me to hire false witnesses who say that he cursed God and the king, and then he'll be taken out and stoned. And they did exactly as she said. They called a fast day. They placed him on the podium. And two evil individuals came. By the way, it always amazes me. You can always find evil individuals who are willing to persecute people for no reason. Never seems to stop. Vayeshu negdai, and they sat against him. Vayidu anshe Belial es Navos neged ha'am lemor, and they testified against them in front of the people. Beirach Navos elokim v'melech vayetzu michutz la'ir vayiskulu ba'monim v'yamos, and they took him out and they killed him. based on their false testimony. Vayishlachu el Izebel Amor, and they so turned to Izebel and they sent back saying, Sukal Novois Vamois. Novois is dead, he's been stoned. Vayichi Shmoa Izebel ki Sukal Novois Vamois. When she hears the report, Vayan Tamer Izebel Elachav, she turns to her husband, she says, Kum Reish, go get up, Eskerem, go and inherit. Eskerem Novois Israeli, go and acquire his vineyard. Asher Me'ein says Lacha Bekesef, that he refused to give it to you, but with money, Ki Ein Novois Chai, Ki Meis. Because he's dead and he's not alive. And now he went and he acquired the vineyard. Very sad story. It's a very sad story on all accounts. If you think about it, yeah, you know, injustice, unfairness. It's just the whole thing doesn't hold together. Very nasty. And it's also remarkable in another sense that, you know, like here we've been dealing with this large, we'll call it, you know, national scene. We've been talking in Perek Chof about the war of Ben-Hadad, Aram, and Achav, and national prophecies in the house of Achav. And then suddenly we have this story, which is a very local drama, right? If you were to be making a documentary, a movie about Perek Chof and Perek Chof Aleph, it would cost you a lot less to create a movie about Perek Chof Aleph. There's fewer people, it's not the national scene, it's only one or two locations, as opposed to the national war, and right, this is a very different, a different scene. So one has to wonder why the two are back-to-back, and in case you think, well, no, this is just a separate story, it's got nothing to do with it. Well, if you go back to the beginning, you look at the first pasuk, the pasuk says, it was after these matters, which means to say that, in fact, the Tanakh says these two are connected. His war with Aram in the north and his individual debacle with Navot seems to be two connected stories. Moreover, if you look at the words as well in that we looked at, we hear that when he gets the refusal, he returns to his house, El Beisoy Sar V'Zaif. He's sullen and he's upset. He's upset about the whole thing. Turns out that those are exactly the words. The last pasuk of the previous perek describes him in the same way. In fact, the way he comes home to his house after receiving the prophecy from Michael saying that he is in fact going to suffer because of his friendship with Ben-Hadad, that it says he returned to his house Sar V'Zaif, the same exact words, which means that something about his debacle with Navot is in fact also reflective of his, we'll call it, national standing as well. And one has to wonder what that is. Why is Tanakh framing it in this way, that the individual story seems to follow directly from the national story? That's our work over here. So let's learn a little bit together, and let's move forward. So a few interesting things to consider. One is the following. Let's try to work on that connection to the previous perek. The Chida points out a very fascinating thing. He points out a psychological insight. He says the following: if you look at the words at the beginning, Kerem Ayala Navoda Yisraeli, actually it is the Sofei Teimos, the last letter acronym. So I'm not sure there's a English word for that yet. But Sofei Teimos, we have Rosh Teimos as an acronym. Sofei Teimos means if you take the last letter of each word, you get the word tema, which means is a Aramaic word for wonder, meaning to say, like, isn't that shocking? Isn't that strange? So if you look at that, right, there's a mem, a hey, a taf, and a yud. Kerem oyal navati Yisraeli, tema. What does that mean? Ki kol isha shebetocho yitama achare shenigzer alav gizere kasha ech yitava tava ki avoid bekerem ra'eyo. He's just received a prophecy about imminent destruction because of his fraternity with his the kingdom of Aram in the north. And the next thing you do, he's busy salivating over his neighbor's vineyard. I mean, like, that should have put things in perspective. You know, imagine, God forbid, that a person was given a certain amount of time for life and a person's told you have so much to live, you know, X, Y, Z to live. Doesn't that change the way you live? Doesn't that change the priorities of what your life is? But no, there he is, off he is. He's just trying to get that vineyard. It's like, you know, forget the landscaping, Achav. Work out your life. Have you spoken to your kids? Do you know what your priorities are? What are you trying to do? So the Chida points out that the contrast is to show you how, we'll call it, perhaps insensitive Achav has been to this whole process, that he's not even taking the necessary lessons from this whole process as well. That's what the Chiddush suggests. The Ababinel has a little bit of a different suggestion as well. He says, Kavonas ha-sipur lo-hoidia, she'im he-yois she-ro Achav es ma'aseh Hashem, ki-no-rahu, even after seeing all the actions of a God, asher-asayim ola ha-fli be-milcha-mois ben-adad, Hashem just performed two miraculous wars for him when fighting the Armenians. Still, he was still willing to go in this direction. He essentially was complicit in the murder of Navot by his wife doing this. Let's think about this. A moment ago, when he had the opportunity to kill this terrible king in the north, Ben-Hadad, he pulls him onto his chariot and he says, "Ah, my brother!" Right? He has this tremendous mercy on this this terrible person, this corrupt human being. So, like Shaul has chemla on the, he has compassion on Agag, the king of Amalek. Levi sherachme reshaim achzari. It turns out that when you have mercy on evil people, that's actually cruelty. It turns out that when you start, we'll call it, you know, diluting your sense of justice, you're going to make bad decisions in the other direction too. Like by Shaul HaMelech, when Shaul ended up having compassion on Agag and ultimately killing Nov Ira Kohanim in his paranoid pursuit of David HaMelech. So in the same way over here, we see what happens is let's contrast the story back to back. Here he is willing to persecute an innocent neighbor for his field, but at the same time bring into his fraternity this cruel king of the north. So the Rabbi Riddell says we ought to be reading these stories back to back to appreciate the corruption of justice, the corruption of uprightness, the corruption of integrity in Achav, which is being highlighted over here. Okay, so that's point number one in terms of reading the stories together. Now, the next point that we ought to be thinking about together as we explore this is it seems very strange on the face of it, this whole business. You know, I assume, like, let's go back to this proposition here. He makes this proposition with Navot and he says, you know, he has the vineyard, I'll give you another one or I'll pay the money and so on. And Navot responds to him. It seems very strange that Achav takes this so badly. I am almost positive that if we were to, like, think ourselves, just in our very small setting of our shir today, with all the people here, I am almost positive that all of us in our lives have placed a bid on real estate that has not come through. Right? That's a pretty regular thing, right? You want a house. It was your dream house. You had your sights set on it. You place a bid and you're out, but okay, it's life. That's how it goes, right? You really wanted it. You really, really, really wanted it. You needed it. You convinced yourself it wasn't a wanted, it was a need. Okay, we all go through things like that. But I mean, like, once you pass the age of 3 years old, you stop sulking about these kind of things, you know? It's like, why is Achav taking this, like, so seriously? He's not eating bread. He's lying on his couch. I mean, Achav, you're the king of Israel. That might be what his wife is actually saying to him, but really, I mean, it's a little astonishing that this is seen to be such a slight to him. That's one thing we should think about. So perhaps the answer to this lies in the way that Navos answers him. Navos actually answers him in a rather startling fashion too. You know, as opposed to saying no, thank you, as opposed to saying, you know, I would really prefer to keep my vineyard. He says, Chalil ali me Hashem, God forbid that I should ever give you my ancestral heritage. It's like, okay. So clearly, the stakes are higher than a real estate bid. That's clear, meaning clearly on the side of Navot, he sees it much more seriously than just buying his vineyard. And clearly Achav takes it more seriously than simply a bid on real estate. Right? Is that clear? That's on both sides over here. Navos takes it far more seriously than simply a request, and Achav is beaten down by his response. So what's really going on here? What's the communication? What's really, really happening in the story? So a few things that are worthwhile noting. Number one is why is Navos so adamant? So Mefarsha Pshat say, this is an example, the Mitzudos says the following. He says, Chalel Ali, chulin chuli, this would be empty or mundane to me, ba'avur mitzvas Hashem, because it's a command of God. Shamra Torah, the Torah says in Parashas Bahar, wa'aretz lo timocher letzmisus, you shouldn't sell your ancestral land, right? There's certain limitations as to selling your tribal territory. Okay? So he's seeing this as why is he invoking HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Because there is a mitzvah in the Torah. Now, there are particular limitations in what the word, what that mitzvah is of Haaretz La Timocher Tzmisus means. It's not so simple, this is a correct application of it, but at least he believes that he is religiously motivated in not allowing this to happen. That's the way the Meforshei Pshat, like as the Mitzvah is suggested. However, it could be that there's a little more going on over here. So as an example, yeah, this is a food for thought experiment, and that is that maybe the idea that's being unpacked over here is that the vineyard is really a metaphor for something, and Navos's lack of willingness to part with it is a metaphor for a lesson he's teaching Achav. Fair? Right? Maybe this is not about the vineyard so much as about really Achav in the larger scheme of things. Let's try to unpack that idea. So the way it's understood is the following. Is the Malbim says it very beautifully. Again, they're all the Meforshim worded differently, but he has the idea that he suggests. Rotze lochiach in source 5, boze, es Achav sh'azav nachlas avosav. Maybe what he's saying is, you, Achav, have abandoned your ancestral heritage. What is that? Shu Hashem Elokei Avosav, which is the Almighty, the God of your fathers. Shu Anachla Yoser Yakar Minachlas Sadeva Kerem Shehem Rak Lachayim Hazmanim. So you have left essentially your inheritance, which is worth much more than any piece of land. Aval Hayemun Avatorah Hinachlas Anefesh. This is the Torah, and spirituality is your spiritual endowment. Without any money, without any price, you just abandon it. God forbid should I relinquish my inheritance, my ancestral heritage. His kirloi eich yakar b'nei ish nilbav chelkas avosav af nachlas manis misade v'kerev v'kol shekein nachala nafshis. I would not let my simple earth in my yard, which belongs to my ancestors, go so easily. How could you have left what your, not is just land, but is your spiritual endowment? How could you just let that go? So now, if that's what's going on over here, now we have a very fascinating debate. So it could have been that Achav himself had interests in simply setting up a meditation garden, right? That could have been the case. But Navos is globalizing this and saying, Achav, I'm not doing what you're doing, which is abandoning your inheritance. And then you can understand why, by a Navos adding in this, we'll call it spiritual dimension to the argument, why Achav is so beaten back in this experience, why he feels so attacked by this, by Navos's argument. This now essentially stretches this perek from being a, we'll call it, a personal drama between neighbors to a national accusation, essentially, as well. That's where the Malbim says it. In fact, just as a fascinating aside, I came across Rav Yigal Ariel suggests in his Sefer Migdash Melech that maybe the word Navot itself is an acronym. Maybe the word Navot is Nachalas Avos, the inheritance of the fathers. Meaning, yes, it is most likely that this actually was something that occurred, and there was a person who was assassinated, executed falsely. But metaphorically also represents inheritance. He represents moving from the old generation to the new generation and retaining tradition, which you, Achav, unfortunately, have not done, and that's what's being suggested over here. Unbelievable. Okay, so that's the level of communication that's going on over here. Let's take it one step further. A very basic question, which I'd like to skip to the end of the sources for a second, is does he really have the right? Does Achav have the right to this land itself? So actually, this is a matter of interesting debate. If you remember all the way back to Sefer Shmuel Aleph, In Sefer Shmuel Aleph, what happens is all the system of government has been shoved in, which means to say leaders who essentially excel themselves by being a leader, they step forward. Othniel ben Knaz, Eil ben Gera, Gidon, Yiftach, all the leaders of Sefer Shmuel, of Sefer Shoftim. Shmuel is the last in the line of that. The people come to Shmuel and say, we want to have a king like everybody else, right? So they make their request. So Shmuel says to them, well, let me tell you a little bit about this king business. You want a new system of government? I want to just make sure you read the fine print. So here's what he says in source 16. He says, Vayadaber eleho, ki adaber, oh, I apologize, I'm in source 17. Zeh ye mishpat ha-melech. This paragraph in Tanakh is called Mishpat ha-melech, based on this pasuk. This is the rules of the king, Hashem Eloich Aleichem, who will rule over you. Es b'nechem yikach, v'sam lo b'mer kavtoi, u'parashov v'ratzu l'fonob b'mer kavtoi. He's going to conscript your sons. So whether you like it or not, they're going to be in his army, they're going to be in his service, because he can do what he wants with your children, which is not the case when it comes to Shoftim. And he goes on, and he gives another, that's Pasuk Yud Aleph, and he gives a whole other examples. He'll take this, he'll take that, he'll requisition this, he'll requisition that. And then in Pasuk Yud Aleph, which is this next line here, he says, Ves odosem, ves charmeichem, ves aizchem, atoivim, yikach v'nosan la'avodov. He can essentially requisition your land. And included in that sentence, this is pretty explicit, is Karmechem, your vineyards. So here we go, let me ask you a question again. According to this, what Shmuel seemed to have said was that a king can, whether you call this eminent domain or not, this is the Mishpat HaMelech, a king has the right to requisition your vineyard. So why is Achav even making a request? He's just saying, he should just put his regal... his regal picket and stick it into the front yard of Navot and say, this is mine now. So what's the debate going on over here? The Gemara in Sanhedrin, describes this and says that there's a debate. Amar Rav Yehuda Meshmuel, kol ha'ayim ha'pashas ha'melech mutar boy. Whatever is described in Shmuel's statement, which we read over here just previously, is mutar loy, meaning to say a king may do such. Rav Amar, lo nemra pashasu ela la'ayim aleihem. This parasha is not actually what he's allowed to do, it is what he may end up doing. Not that this is legal for him to do. Meaning what Shmuel is saying is like this. You think and you look around and you say, oh, all these kings are wonderful, kings are great, red carpet, scepters, crowns, the whole business. So he says, look, there's other stuff that comes with it, right? And that is that when there's absolute power, it corrupts absolutely, and it's going to end up being that they're just going to take your thing. So it's not that he's allowed to do it. So perhaps this is a limited scope. It's interesting how this plays itself out in Halacha. There is a discussion in Halacha. The Rambam actually makes a very interesting comment in Halacha where he believes a king does have the right for eminent domain, but it's a larger machlokes in the Gemara here. The way the Rambam ends up coming out and suggesting over here is that he has the right to eminent domain in the case of emergency or in a national need. Okay, so there's certain limitations in this. So it's not just carte blanche. So the Mepharshim all say, well, if that's the case, if to a certain degree he does have rights, why is it that in this particular case he seems to be negotiating, he loses the deal, why is this so important to him? Why does Navot have the right to turn him down? So the Tosfos actually on this Gemara, the Academy of Rashi's grandchildren and beyond, ask exactly this question. They say, in source 19, tamer, this is strange. Remember, that's our word tamer that the Chida used. It's a word that's just commonly used in Tosfos. It's so strange. Lama ne'anash, Achav anavot, kevan shalei ratzalim kor lo kamar. Why was Achav punished? Navot should have given him the vineyard, right? So he gives a number of suggestions. The last suggestion that Tosfos present is the following. In amid the parshas melech lo nemra rak al melech shenimlach al kol Yisrael v'yuda me'es ha-makom. The only king who has the rights of the king, of the Mishpat HaMelech, as prescribed by Shmuel HaNavi, is a king who is the king over all of Israel and who is accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Achav le'molach al Yehuda, v'gav le'molach me'ez le'makom. Achav had the limitation that he was not a king over all of Israel, he was only a king of the northern territories, and he was not with the blessing of the Almighty. His father, maybe you could argue, was Omri, but Achav said, had transgressed Hashem's words multiple and numerous times. So Tosfos is saying that. So now let's put that back into the conversation here. Does Achav potentially have the right to requisition the land? Answer is yes. But is he able to? No. And what Navos is pointing out to him as well is you don't because you aren't. Navos could be answering like Tosos is suggesting. You aren't really the full king. You don't have the people's blessing. You don't have the Almighty's blessing. So again, now putting that back into the religious response of Navos, Chalila li me Hashem, God forbid that you should get the field. What he's essentially saying as well over here, if we import this into it, is you ain't really the king. You don't have the credentials. That also helps us understand why he takes it so seriously, why Achav sees this as such an affront to him as well. Another possibility as to why this is, why he sees it as such, the response of the Rashba Rav Shlomo Ibn Aderet, one of the great leaders of Spanish Jewry, one of the medieval commentators, he's a commentator on almost all the Gemara, wrote many responsa. He says the following, V'kachra Yisi, in source 20, She'ena devarim amurim ela b'meh shehu na'aseh b'dinei malchus. When do you have to listen to the king? When it's done, when it's government policy. She'kol am v'am. Yesh lechukim yudu'im b'dinei malchus. V'dine de malchus amru, dine de malcha lo amru. He says the rule is that if it's a government policy, then you listen to it. If it is a king policy, you don't have to listen to it. Meaning, what is the Rashba essentially saying? If what is the king is demanding something which is for the national good of the people, then yes, you do. That's the rules. But if the king makes a request and he says, you know, it's very important that later tonight at 10:30, somebody could deliver 37 doses of the vaccine before it's available to the public. If you could just put it around the service entrance and knock 3 times and leave a box there, right? We don't have to listen to those laws. Because clearly that's about a king subverting the law for his own interest. That's called dinner de malka, not dinner de malchusa. That's the king's interest, not the interest of the country. Then there's a limitation in the Mishpat HaMelech. That's what Rashba says, which makes a whole lot of sense. So even though the same king may be issuing the command, it's not about him issuing it as a king for the people, but a king for himself. And that's not what we listen to. What Navot might be responding, another trajectory, another perspective over here, is that imported into the words of Navos is the following. Is Navos is saying, oh king, it sounds very nice that you're asking for this Gan Yarok, but you know what? This doesn't have to do with wars. It doesn't have to do with conscription. It doesn't have to do with taxes. This has to do with the fact that you want a green yard. You want to be able to meditate in the mornings. You want to be able to smoke your cigar overlooking the beauty of my beautiful vineyard. Well, I'm sorry. That's not what I have to do. This is a country which is not governed by power. It's a country governed by God and the principles of God. So that's what perhaps Navos is also asking as well. In fact, some of the Mefarshim even suggest that Achav had interest in turning this into a Gan Yarok, into a pagan yard. So he's going to have this as a place of worship, outdoor worship, right? Outdoor worship is very popular. So maybe we can do that in the yard. And that's also perhaps the way he's saying this is not an interest that I am subject to. Based on the suggestion of the Rashba. So if we looked at it from this perspective, we've imported 3 different possibilities as to why Navos's rejection is, we'll call it a religious rejection rather than simply a financial rejection, right? The idea that the Malvim suggested is that the vineyard is metaphoric of ancestral inheritance. The idea of the fact that of Tosos, that maybe the king does have rights, but not in this case because it is not at the bequest of the people or God. And the Rashba is the fact that this is ultimately a personal request, not a national request. All of these added together give us a very, you know, clear understanding as to why Navos walks back to his house so dejected. In fact, the same words, Sar v'za'if, in the same way that he was rejected by the prophet Michayahu, because this was not simply the rejection of his bid on the vineyard, it was his rejection as a king, which now enters, and now we can understand, enter Izevel. Right, let's understand where Izevel plays into this. So she comes in and she says, the first word she says, now let's understand her words. She says the following. She says, "Vatomer elav, Izevel ishtoi pasuk zayin, ata ta'aseh melucha. You will now be king al Yisrael." Why does she say that? Because she understands well that was what was under attack. She understands that you need to be a king. You need to act like a king. Now, we could have read this as she's saying is, honey, you're acting like a child. Get off the couch. Let's go. That's what she could be saying, right? Act like a king. But I think that deeper embedded in this is, atah ta'aseh melucha, is even though there are those who may disagree with you, you deserve to be a king. You deserve to act like a king. And I'm going to make you that king, essentially, Isabel suggests as well. Okay, so let's go a little further. Now, so let's go back to her pretext. What does she do? She sends off this letter, she sends it off to the elders, and she essentially frames him for a crime. Few things to think about over here. The crime that she chooses to frame him is the crime of Birchas Hashem v'Hamelech, cursing the king and God, which was a capital crime. Why do you think she chooses this particular methodology of slander? The answer is very clear, very simple. And that is for the following reason. Is because any other capital punishment, or most other ones, would involve a victim. Right? So let's say she accused him of murder. Well, where's the body? If she accused him of kidnapping, well, where was the kid? Right? Any other capital crime, if it's on a social level, will require some form of victim, and she can't fabricate that so easily. So it's easier for her to fabricate a ritual crime, something which has been Adam Lamakom, and to get away with it, because there's nobody besides the witnesses who are privy to this cursing of God and the king. So now here's an interesting question, which I never thought about this beforehand, but it makes so much sense. The Malbim asks an unbelievably sharp question, and it should startle us if we didn't think about this. I did not think about this. But here's what he says in Source 6. Yipolema od, says the Malbim. This is uncanny. Eich loy hisyare milichtov b'shem ha-melech ela zekenim v'achorim sheyiskeru eidei sheke v'yeidu eidus sheke on the voice v'yishvishiputu al zeh mishpat maves. How does she have the audacity to take the king's signet ring and place it in writing on such a conspiracy? U'mata ha-seim ha-zekenim yiru yismichtov ha-melech el kol ha-am all you need is for that letter to go public. And now you see that the king on his own stationery is framing an innocent victim. I mean, that's the end of his kingship if this were to go public. This is unbelievable. This is, you know, in all kinds of nefarious activities, the first rule is don't commit it to writing. And number two is if you're going to commit it to writing, don't put your signet ring on it. I mean, this is just unbelievable. What is she doing? The people, why will the people reject the king? Not because they have so much, you know, compassion on Navos per se, but they're going to say, well, if you allow this to happen, the next time the king wants to frame me, that's what's going to happen. This is from a utilitarian perspective, this is not going to work. So why wouldn't those elders show the public this terrible action? Even in the darkest of ages, you don't see nefarious activities being committed to paper like this. Okay, good. Anyway, so that's the Malbim's question. Very, very good question, right? It's a very important question to struggle with here. So he says the following. He says, "Vatichtov." She wrote, "Hine he shama ve'vino gamken ki navos kiven nevazoyes es havorazara eich she'achav hemir nachalas avosav." She understands that between the lines, Navos is really attacking not just Achav, but he is attacking the very deity that he is serving, which, by the way, is her deity. Let's put the ego in here for a second, okay? Right, she brought all these folks in from her Phoenician background. And he spoke very disrespectfully by saying, Chalila libe Hashem. And even though they weren't witnesses, so even if the king was privy to this, he was present when Navos said this to him, the king can't act as a witness because, in fact, he is also the victim of this cursing. Yes, the fact that he cursed God, the Achav can testify to. So she says, let's put him to court. Let's put him in the docket. for these two issues. He cursed both the deity and the king. So let's turn to the Chorim, which are essentially these are the officers. That's going to be the king's department. And let's turn to the Zekanim, that is the God's department. And that's what it says. Achav ki achav meyid. Achav is testifying. Shenavos birech elokim v'melech. Navos essentially cursed God and king. Uvozeh loikos v'sheker. She was not being false. Ki be'emes bizar es achav ve'elohav. He was cursing Achav and his gods, not God with a capital G. So the Zekanim are the elders of her priesthood, who are going to now stand up for her priesthood. And the Chorim are those who are going to take umbrage for the king being so spoken to. And it goes describes why he's over there. So what she is essentially saying is, what the Malbim is explaining is that Izebel is not being, is not taking subterfuge and conspiracy, and she's not actually framing something that she doesn't believe happened. She believes it did happen. She believes this conversation with Navos, in fact, was the cursing of gods, her gods, and the cursing of the king, her king, and that's why she sets it up in such a way. And she would be very happy if this letter were to be leaked to the public, because she stands by it, and by the fact that it has Achav's signet on it, is in fact the testimony itself that the king was in fact present when this occurred. So this is the plan which is going on over here. So she sees it as treason essentially, and is just simply taking action on it as well. Now, a few other questions. Why is it that they need the pretext of the fast day? So just say like this. She should just send like this. Send her a subpoena to the house of Navot. Bring him to the based into the Chorem and the Zekanim. Say there was a cursing of God that occurred. I'm sorry, it has your name on it. And please step outside to the scaffold. Right. So that should be the end of the day. Why do they need to have the whole business with the fast day? Why that whole pretext? The Radak explains Kirutzon Kamash Moi Loshan Tanis the Katirgom Yonatan Gozru Tsum of Amru Ze Levisha Beyom Hisvad Hatanis Me Pash Beshin Bemaasehem Vyem Yesh Muvas Mesaknosai. So maybe it's a day which is open to introspection. It's a day open to people saying, well, let's fix up what's going on. How can we do better? That's, and therefore, in that milieu, now they're able to say, we just received this note, and it seems to be that we need to fix this up, and we can fix you up as well, right? So that's what seems to be going on. It says the Radak, V'adoni Avi Zichron Levrochi, the Radak quotes his father, and he says, Pirish, Tzom Kibbutz, V'chem V'yom Tzom Shebi Yirmiyahu Meloshen Razal, Tzom Es Hagidim, Shumokom Kibbutz Hagidim. So he says, it's a day of gathering. So it sounds like he wants to be, it's meant to be a day in which there are many people there together. And what she's trying to do is to make this a public spectacle in such a way, perhaps to scare off future people as well. Okay, so this seems to be what's being described. Now, so after all is said and done, Achav gets up. Achav is now in the vineyard and he's all happy, right? So this is the end of that story, but it's not the end of the story, because now we have Eliyahu enters Eliyahu. Now remember, Eliyahu has been retired. Eliyahu has not been here, but however he continues at this point in time because he's now going to settle this case. Hashem speaks to Eliyahu, "Kum raid, go down." Go down to his vineyard, the one that he illegally took over. And says, speak to him, saying, that's a very strong statement. Did you murder and take possession? You should speak to him. When Navoz's blood lay on the ground, your blood will be lapped up by the dogs as well in the same space. Oh, you found me, my enemy. Meaning to say, Achav has a long-standing antagonism with Eliyahu. I have found you. Because you have, now the way they translate over here is given yourself over. You have, from the word mechira. There's another word that's also related to that as well. Can anybody think about what that is? The word over here could also be not just sold, but also the idea is also from the word nechar as well, which means to be foreign, to be hidden from. If we come back to that in a second. I'm going to remove everybody from your family. I'm going to destroy everybody from your family. And I'm going to remove your dynasty, like I removed the previous two dynasties of Israel, the dynasty of Yerovam, the dynasty of Baasha. She'll be consumed by the dogs, not just her blood. She'll be eaten by the dogs by the wall of the moat of Israel. The dead of your family will be eaten in the city by the dogs, and the dead of your family in the fields will be eaten by the birds of the heaven. There was no one like Achav who did so bad because he was, in fact, stirred to do so. He was convinced to do so because of his wife. And he went, did terrible, abominable things by following the idols that were of the peoples before him. So this is a very strong, very, very strong idea over here. Now, what the main accusation, and this is such an important point over here, is this prophecy of destruction. It's the last prophecy of destruction that Achav is going to receive, essentially. Well, there is another one, but that's more of a, we'll see, that's really a seduction into war. We'll get to next parak, hopefully. But over here you see something which is very, very important. And that is the relationship that Achav has with his wife. That's a very important relationship to understand. Because after all, he married her as a Phoenician because it was a political alliance. But with her, she brought all the abominations, all the complexities of the foreign cultures around. And that's when Baal, and that's where all these Asherah, all the idol worship, the persecution of the Nevi Hashem came into being in such a, we'll call it, national policy. And one may say to oneself, you know what? Was it really Achav? Or was it really Izebel? Right, who was really the evil person here? Now, Izebel was evil through and through. She was, you know, there was no saving grace from Izebel. But maybe you say to yourself, well, is it really Achav's problem? And the answer really comes down to yes. This story, perhaps, is another example of the metaphor which shows that it is his problem. Here is the same situation that occurs. If you look, there's different ways of looking at this. The way that Rabbi Alex Israel suggests, I think it's a very beautiful way of looking at the parak, is if you look at the scenes of this parak, there's essentially five scenes. The first scene is Achav and Navos in the vineyard. Scene number two is Achav in his house, not eating, and his wife conversing with him. And she says, do your king stuff, I'll take care of this. Scene three is when she sends the letter in the town square when Navos is executed summarily. And the fourth scene is the note that Izebel receives and her telling her husband he's dead back in the palace. And the fifth scene is now back in the vineyard where Eliyahu comes and visits Achav and says, Haratzachta gam yorashta. If you think about it, it is chiastic in structure, in the sense that the wings all look like each other. So the first and last scene are in the vineyard. The second and fourth scene are in the palace between Izebel and Achav. And the middle scene is where the murder takes place, the execution takes place. You'll notice one fascinating thing, and that is that in place of Navot, in the beginning in the vineyard, you now have Eliyahu, almost so to speak, his vicarious agent, his proxy representing him, right, which makes sense. One thing you do see fascinating is that Achav is found in four of the five scenes. He's found negotiating, he's found in the palace, he's not found in the murder and execution conspiracy. He is found when Izebel talks to him and he does go and inherit the field and he's there with Eliyahu when Eliyahu visits him. Which means that for the critical moment of crime, Achav is absent. And I think that's exactly the point. Even though he is absent, You don't have the right to claim innocence when it was under your auspices. When it's under your auspices, you bear the responsibility. It was your signet ring. You know, I'm just reading a book called Extreme Ownership by a couple Navy SEALs who operated in Iraq, and number of the leadership lessons they learned from it. One of the cases they talk about was when they had this particular operation in a very dangerous area, and there were a number of different teams operating. So there were SEALs, there was a cannon division, artillery division, there was a marine division. They were all operating together, and one of the SEAL squad commanders found that there was a particular holdout in a building, and fierce fighting that was going on between the militia inside and the Marines, and they just received permission to blow up the building, and the SEAL commander realized, he just said that something doesn't make sense. So what he did was he went and investigated, and he managed to get into the building, and he found that in fact in the building were not militia, but one of his SEAL teams, one of the sniper SEAL teams, which meant to say that the entire battle which had been taking place was what was called blue on blue. So one of the worst things that can happen, which is friendly fire. And he managed to avoid them, the entire team being blown up, which was an amazing thing. But there was an investigation which was sent in, some senior officers were sent in to investigate it. And the commander describes, the commander of this unit describes, as he turns to his troops and he says to them, as the auditors, these generals come in to investigate, this is a very serious thing when there's a blue on blue. And he turns to his team and he says, who's responsible for this? So the radio operator says, I was, because I didn't communicate that we changed our position. He says, you're not responsible. He says, who's responsible for this? And then the Marine commander said, you know, we moved into the location an hour early, so the SEAL team didn't know that it was us. He says, no, not your problem. So then one of the Iraqi officers gets up and said, it was my problem because we sent the Iraqi officers in first, which looked like it was part of the militia. And he says, not your problem. And he turned to everyone and he said, I'm responsible because I'm the commander. Meaning to say, extreme ownership means to say that you take responsibility. You didn't make those individual mistakes, but your team made those mistakes. And if all these multiple mistakes add up to a fatal problem, then it's your responsibility. Achav, in the end of the day, you may not be there when the murder took place, but your wife comes to you and says to you, you know, I'm going to take care of this. Take care of this, right? Actually, we have a very special individual in our shul, Dr. Murray Cohen, and he was a dentist. When he was first in practice, he used to work in a particular area in Brooklyn. And I remember that Susan told me a fascinating thing, and that is, she said that he used to service a lot of Italians. You know, and from time to time they would come to him, and they would, you know, and many of his people actually, you know, sort of spent time in jail and coming out, and they would always come to him and they'd say, Dr. Cohen, do you need anybody to be fixed up? You know, if there's anybody in the neighborhood who's giving you trouble, we can fix them up, you know. So when Ezebel says to you, I'll fix the situation, you should understand what that means. And when Ezebel comes back and says, you know, it's the funniest thing, you know, that vineyard that you were talking about the other day, and, you know, he's dead. It's just amazing, right? So Achav doesn't say, what, how, when, what happened, I'm so sorry, when was the funeral? None of that. He doesn't ask anything. He just goes, walks out, takes his deck chair, and there he is. I mean, so the point is that, Achav, you cannot ignore evil under your nose. You don't have the right to ignore what's going on under your nose. You bear the responsibility for what's going on in your kingdom, even in your absence. That's the metaphor of this parak. The metaphor of what Eliyahu is saying to him is, you have allowed evil in, even if you yourself may not have the fingerprints on all of that evil. And in the same way you're going to be held accountable for the murder of Navot, you're going to be held accountable for all the rest of the evil that your wife has brought into this kingdom, which was under your auspices. That's what's being told to him. In fact, this is what my Rabbi Niel says in Source 8, Ismar kercho in your noi, you make yourself all innocent. I had no idea. I had no idea. Navos just disappeared. He went away the other day. I didn't see him come back. The word is not from the word mechira, rather from the word naker, from to become a foreign, not knowing. As if he had no knowledge over here about this. And that explains, says Rabbi Abinel, why Zevil gets a separate punishment. She's going to be killed in the area that Navos was killed. So yes, he's not going to be eaten by the dogs in the area, but which is a terrible, terrible, God forbid, punishment. But at the same time, he is held accountable. So yes, Ezebel does get a worse punishment, but he is held accountable for what happens under his rule. And finally, how does Achav respond to this? So the last few psukim in the parak tell us, "Vayikishma Achav esed dvarim ha'ele, vayikra begadov, vayosem sak al basaroi, vayotzom, vayishkav basak vayelech at." He wears sackcloth. He walks around slowly, showing that his life has changed. Vayhi devar Hashem el Eliyahu v'tishpi lemor, Hashem returned to Eliyahu to say, Haro'isa ki nichna Achav milfonai, Achav has humbled himself in front of me, yan ki nichna miponai lo'avi hara b'yomov. I won't bring this evil during his lifetime, b'mei b'noi avi hara al b'esoi, but it will still happen, but in the times of his son. So he won't witness all this evil. So the punishment of his death is still there, but the punishment of the family will not be in his lifetime. The Mefarshim and the Midrashim debate how sincere this Shiva process was. Bir Azmeh says the Ralbag does actually happen. He says, V'efshav sh'ne'emar sh'aratzon boy, ki b'mokom ahu b'eino yalakua klavim istamoy, ach mibnei ki nichna acha b'mei Hashem yisparach herich lo'ize ad yemei b'noi. Hashem did not change this, he just gave him more time. Some of this evil did occur to Achav, right, as it says, that is Shilakukla Klovim is Damoi, Shinishtatef Minarechev al Birkov, Birkas Shomron, Omar, Brecha Shomron, Vashomki, Hazonos Rachatzula, Flig, Bissipur, Hoinesh Achav, Vuhusha, Hazonos, Rachatzos, Berecha, Vahi, Rachzumi Damoi, Klovim Lokoku Damoi. So at the end of the day, he did a certain element of this punishment happens because we're going to see he's going to be mortally wounded. And as he's mortally wounded, his chariot is pulling him back to his capital city. And as he's being pulled in the chariot, his blood is flowing down his legs onto the ground and it enters into the pool. So yes, the dogs will ultimately drink his blood, but not in the same way perhaps as the initial prophecy was, but that does have some sort of level of veracity, some level of fulfillment, which is occurring. So this is a very powerful description here. This is a very powerful story. This is not simply a story about a disgruntled person and injustice and conspiracy. This really is the metaphor for what has happened now, and unfortunately therefore becomes the critical last nail in the coffin of Achav and Udi'ime and those who are with him. So this concludes Perek Chof Aleph, a chapter which requires a lot of attention, a lot of thought. We will continue, Mitzvah Hashem, as we enter into the last Perek Chof Beis, which is the final battle of Achav.